lagging rate of daily vaccinations in the United States. The pandemic here continues to be on the downswing. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AT2CDF. Okay, here's an interesting one that I have on my little list. A 7-year-old boy who accidentally got wet cement all over his head and torso ended up in an emergency room after the cement mixture burned his skin, according to a new report. A family member had been mixing and pouring cement when the boy, who was playing nearby, walked under the wet cement dispenser, according to the report published June 2nd in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. A little while later, the boy experienced a burning pain and his skin reddened. He was taken to a healthcare facility where staff washed his skin with an organic substance called polyethylene glycol. Then he was transferred to the hospital on whether his burns needed further treatment. There, doctors noted the boy had superficial burns or first-degree burns on his head, neck, and torso, according to the authors from Vanderbilt University. They also saw that the cement mixture had been completely washed off, and particles still clung to the skin and hair. Wet cement should never be left on the skin for a very long time. The substance can cause severe chemical burns. Let me drop for a sec. That's because cement is made up mostly of a compound called calcium oxide. When it's mixed with water, it becomes highly basic or alkaline, meaning it has a high pH, according to the National Capital Poison Center. A substance's pH is measured on a scale from 0 to 14. Substances with a low pH are acidic, while substances with a high pH are alkaline. Wet cement can be have a pH as high as 14, the author said. Contact with wet cement does immediately cause chemical burns, but if someone has prolonged contact with the material, for instance, if they are inhaling the cement to pour it, or if the material is left on the skin for a long period of time, it can cause burns. The average time between an exposure to wet cement and time to burn is approximately 6 hours. The author said, because of this delay, people may not realize that cement caused a burn. Quote, wet cement is often poorly recognized cause of alkaline studies. Authors wrote, and when you recognize doctors more often see this type of injury in adults who've been working with cement. Wet cement burns are rarely seen in children, making the current case unique to us. Best treatment involves washing the skin with copious water to get wet cement off, the author said. Doctors sometimes use other solutions, including the polyethylene glycol mentioned earlier, to wash the skin, but there's no real evidence that these are any better alternatives to water. If the burns are severe enough, they will remain in surgery. In current case, poor skin with irrigated water until all the cement is removed and evaluated by a burn specialist, who determined that the boy did not need further treatment. Fortunately, the patient involved in this case was decontaminated early enough and a surgical intervention was required. The author said he was discharged from the hospital and made a full recovery. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2.
WP2EAB.
Yes, Ted.
Polyethylene glycol. Isn't that an antifreeze? Two, you said wet cement can have a pH of 14. That's higher than lye. That would have done a lot. I mean, I don't believe it can go that high. That's like the upper limit. And three, I'm wondering if the fact that wet cement can get warm or even hot might possibly have something to do with it, might possibly be partially thermal.
Okay, Ed, we'll take it 1, 2, and 3. 1, yes, you are quite right. That is antifreeze. Again, it's on the list of things to use. There's no real proof that it's any more effective than water. That's 1. 2 is that cement can be as high a pH as 14. I think in most cases it's not. So you're kind of right, although they're just describing the range. I don't think the young kid was exposed to basically lye and it just sat there for a while. So you're right, and to a degree they're right. But, you know, it's a matter of semantics. And the third is that there is a degree of chemical reaction which produces heat. My guess would be this heat damage would present more earlier than the alkaline chemical damage, simply because we are kind of better suited to respond to actual thermal burns rather than chemical burns.
What little tidbit about heat?
Yeah, tip it away, please, then.
About 10 years ago, the XYL and I went on a little trip to the Southwest. We flew into Las Vegas. We were not impressed. But we made a point to hitting Hoover Dam and took the tour there. And that was fascinating. And one of the things is, when they were building the Hoover Dam, they had to pump water through the curing concrete because they were worried that so much concrete in one area would cause it to heat up tremendously and it would last for hundreds of years.
Okay, it sounds a wee bit of hyperbole, hundreds of years. I mean, yes, cement undergoes an exothermic chemical reaction, and there are things like PFOS that have been on fire for a long, 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 long time. But I don't know. Did you particularly buy the cement curing for hundreds of years?
The point that they emphasize, and you may not understand, is just how much concrete there is in one place.
Okay, in this case, it was a kid kind of playing around the dispenser. So he was just getting the stuff just kind of poured on him.
Yeah, this was billions of tons. I mean, the Hoover Dam is like 80 feet wide at the top and several hundred feet wide at the bottom. It's like 500 feet high. It's about a mile across. That is one load of concrete. I mean, they were pouring concrete for like 2 years straight.
Okay, I'm not aware of the longest recorded curing date at the time frame for even large collections of cement. It seems like centuries are a little bit over it.
It was academic because they ran pipes to pump water through it to cool it down.
The U.S. plant.
Yes, Paul.
A construction site for 28 days, you know, so that's the number that they use. For instance, you put a light pole in somewhere, and they come back and put the pole up to the yard. Stuff might be sticking out of it, but they have to come back with, you know, greater than 28 days, you know, a month.
Okay, 28 days, certainly. You might be referring to something that they said that's absolutely positively correct. I have no expertise in the exothermic response of curing cement related to its mass. Cement is, though, generally speaking, a fascinating subject in general. The Romans had a particular technology in making cement that lasted millennia. That was sort of lost until very recently, and then discovered to basically be that they used ash of local volcanoes in the Italian peninsula. So cement is fascinating stuff. You know, it's chemistry, it's architecture, building, culture, engineering, designing, all kinds of fun stuff.
Okay, yeah, it came up on the tag 9 years ago. You know, with putting up towers, you know, you put up a 40-foot tower, you pour the concrete, you're really not supposed to put that tower up right away. You're supposed to wait that minimum 28 days. Back to you.
Okay, very good. And I will at my leisure Google, all this stuff and I too travel to Las Vegas and to the dam. Fascinated by the dam. Kind of disappointed. It sounds like you were sort of disappointed. Maybe I was disappointed for different reasons. I, having visited, passed by 42nd Street in its worst condition, I was assuming a den of iniquity in Las Vegas, and it was more like a plastic amusement park for adults.
All I can say is, USL, message acknowledged. Yeah.
I mean, even the darn alcohol was watered down. I looked around and I just shrugged my shoulders. Maybe because I'm not a gambler. I think it's different if you're a gambler.
Yeah, but serious gamblers couldn't care less about the scenery.
I would agree with you. I mean, it's for the guys in CSI in, Indiana, Idaho, places like that, I guess. I mean, if you've experienced the decadence of Manhattan, there's nothing that Las Vegas or Nevada in general is really going to present to you, I think.
Well, I remember when I saw the New York show. Now, keep in mind, this was over 10 years ago. They have like this little model of the Empire State Building that defines tech. But what I thought was true was they do have a little model of the Brooklyn Bridge, which is really just like, instead of the sidewalk, they made the sidewalk look like the Brooklyn Bridge. I thought that one was true.
Okay, I mean, fortunately, I have no way of knowing about any of this. My sojourn to Las Vegas was back in the 80s. That was just before the kind of middle-class businessman kind of took over the whole thing as opposed to the shady mob oriented guys. The employees were still living in trailer parks adjacent to the hotels. Major investment in real estate hadn't really taken off quite yet. So it was a sort of a different place, but in many ways sort of the same place.
One other attraction of Las Vegas that nobody sees. From Hoover Dam, we had to drive up to Utah. And I got an idea. Instead of going up the interstate, we drove around Lake Mead. And if you didn't see the lake, you might as well have been on the moon. There wasn't even a plate of... There wasn't even a single lake. Not even a plate of sagebrush.
It's a shame I didn't take that route. I don't exactly remember the details because it goes back, like I said, to the 80s, but I remember I think I went with a bunch of guys to conventions in California. We rented a car and we drove from California to Las Vegas. I think on the way maybe we did Hoover Dam, or on the way out we did Hoover Dam. I'm not quite sure. I don't remember those little details, but it's a shame that I missed it. I would have liked that. I went up to, when I was in California, the same type of a trip, I went to Mount Palomar. That was interesting. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff was closed for different reasons. They were fixing the telescope, I think, but fascinating nevertheless.
Yeah, I almost but never did make it to Mount Palomar.
Well, if you're into telescopes, it really looks special. It's a very big telescope. Obviously, they basically just show you the telescope and then show you the gift shop, and that's kind of it. But, if you're into telescopes, it was a fun day. It was a mountain, so there's a lot of driving up the mountain and a lot of driving back down the mountain.
You know, talking about this, I don't hear any big backlog I'm interrupting. But I do have a story that you and maybe the other people might be interested in, having to do with the effects of plate tectonics.
Sure, Ed. I don't want to take anything away from Paul and the SpaceNet report, but I'd love to hear it.
As a result of plate tectonic action, the northwestern United States has three major volcanoes, Mount Hood, Mount St. Helens, and Mount Rainier. And as everybody knows, Mount St. Helens let go in 1980. I was there in 1993. And when they built the visitor center and everything, and we went there. And it makes you realize that Mother Nature can be really, really, really nasty. And when I looked at Mount St. Helens itself, I had this feeling of evil in my gut as you look at the shape of the mountain and see how much of it is missing. There was something, yeah, I know all about the whole chemistry, physics, and everything of it, but still I couldn't shake this feeling of evil looking at it. Now, are you ready for part two?
Yep.
About 5 years ago, James Swayel and I went to about a week or so in Italy, and of course we saw Pompeii. And Pompeii itself was exactly what I've expected. Everybody's read about Pompeii. There are no hidden surprises, except one. Pompeii was obliterated when Vesuvius erupted. And when I saw Vesuvius from Pompeii, my jaw dropped. I said, oh my God, I've been here before. It's Mount St. Helens. Pompeii was obviously obliterated in a pyroclastic flow.
Yeah, that's the way I heard it described. I tend not to think of nature as evil. The thing that frightens me is that nature is quite blatantly indifferent. Nature doesn't give a damn. I could use foul words, but the FCC won't let me. That stuff just happens not for a reason, not for a rhyme. It's nothing personal, it's not business, it's just the laws of thermodynamics doing their thing, and if it runs over you, then that's life.
No, that isn't life, that's dead.
Well, it's the cessation of life. Let's meet in the middle.
Yeah, but I really found that interesting, and I was surprised by the reaction I had.
Okay, I mean, you know, it's very rare, fortunately or unfortunately, for us to get a real sense of the awesome power that is nature in general, the wide expanses of the universe, incredible depth of it all, and our kind of meaninglessness to it all. So I can certainly understand that epiphany.
Yes, and here's a perfect lead-in to Paul. We know that the Earth has been involved in collisions with foreign objects, specifically 60-odd million years ago. My question is, we now have the technology to identify something looking to sneak up on us and do it again and do something about it. But my question is humanity too stupid to actually do something about it until it's too late? And if anybody is doing anything significant, maybe Paul knows or could research that for us.
Okay, very good, Ed. I, unfortunately, being a cynic, would vote on the being stupid, especially after having lived through the last year and a half. I've seen a heck of a lot of stupid out there. The last stupid I saw was some lunatic Dr. of osteopathy suggest that vaccines magnetize people.
Yes, yes, and I had a little comeback. Give me a minute to think about it. Ah, yes, I remember now. I met with some people in the Boy Scouts, and I said that would be wonderful because then we can hike in the woods. We wouldn't need a compass. We would serve the job. Our bodies would serve that purpose.
Well, but you would need some guy who could float on the water or something.
Nah, that's only for beginners.
Okie doke. Very good, Ed. I appreciate this presentation and all the ones that came before and hopefully the future ones that will come after it. Let me now, because it's already turning to 10:25, please, the full WS2N, and once again, the full had a great presentation at this past Wednesday's general meeting, and they did report it, so I'm hoping that the powers that be in Bymark publish it somewhere so that people who missed Paul's presentation can take it in. But Paul, WS2S, please come and give us the statement report.
Okay, very good. WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, okay, on the presentation. Yeah, they recorded, but whenever they get around to it, they'll eventually put it on the website, the Limewalk website. And I'm thinking about the all the asteroids and that Ed's talking about eventually will hit the Earth. And yeah, there's some involvement looking into that. We have the DART mission coming up not too long from now. And that's going to spacecraft out to one asteroid. Yeah, it's not coming here, but it's, you know, it's relatively close to Earth. It has a moon going around it. So what they want to do is they want to hit that moon with the asteroid, with the spacecraft. 1,100 pound copper weight, you know, that's going to shoot at it at 18,000 miles an hour. And it will, the idea is it will change the orbit that on the bigger asteroid. By doing that, it will actually change the bigger asteroid's speed, so it will change the orbit relative to the Earth. So they're thinking about it, if they could do this, how much power would you really need, or how effective this idea would be. It's called the DART mission. European Space Agency has another launch that they plan on launching afterwards to visit the same two asteroids, take pictures. You know, they got magnetometers and all kinds of equipment to see the changes that have occurred after we hit it with the DART. So that's one thing. You know, I mean, it's something, but it's not enough. You know, it'll give them some kind of an idea of what it would take to really move a single asteroid from the present orbit. But they just want to see if they can change it. Anything, a little bit. And there is one astronaut, Rusty Schweikin. Schweikin, he was up on one mission, Apollo 9. He went in orbit around the Earth on one of the early Apollo tests. He tested out the LEM. What LEM actually went to lunar orbit. Well, he's retired, but last 20 years or more, he's been pushing for some kind of system to look at all these near-Earth asteroids that come nearby. And he wants to catalog all of them. Right now, they think there's a certain percentage, maybe 10% or so. He's got another 90% or so that are not cataloged. He's been pushing for this one particular mission he calls Sentinel. Now, Sentinel would be a spacecraft, essentially a telescope, that would be launched roughly around the Venus orbit, you know, at that same distance from the sun. But the camera was always looking out as it goes around the sun. As it's going around, it'll be looking at all the different asteroids that come anywhere near Earth. It'll be looking out toward the orbit of maybe catalog, you know, hundreds of thousands of possible near Earth asteroids. But you know, he can never raise the money. He always tried to, you know, talk Congress into doing it, and somebody. But you know, it's on the drawing board. You know, they have plans for it. They just can't get it funded. I think it would be, well worthwhile. But like anything else, you know, maybe we have to get hit with something bigger than what hit Russia that one time. Say, you know, we got to do something about it. Anyway, let me continue on with the space net report. Unless you have a comment on this particular topic, WS. Okay, very good. Well, thank you for bringing that up. That was that, right? Right, that brought that up?
Yeah. By the way, I didn't get a chance. Thank you very much for addressing.
Okay. Very good. My own key too long. I forget who said that. Very good. Thanks. Okay. There's going to be a launch, suborbital launch, coming up on July 20th. July 20th. The fifth landing on the moon for Apollo 11. You know, with Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Mike Collins, the man module. And this launch is going to be from Texas. It's going to be suborbital. And it's going to be by Blue Origin. They're the ones that have built the Shepard rocket, the Shepard consists of one booster. It's only a single stage rocket with one liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket attached to it. And they've tested this New Shepard, I think it's around 12 or 13 times. And it goes up around 2 miles high.
Now, he's going to put himself up in space. It's interesting that he resigned from Amazon as the CEO. I think that that officially takes place a week or so before he takes off in space. It makes me wonder if this has something to do with it. You know, maybe some kind of insurance or something involved. For the company to be, sustainable in case of, something goes wrong. But it seems to coincide with the resigning of the head of Amazon to being one of the sets that's, involved now with his company blew up. Also building the New Glenn. He named it the New Shepard. He's a Valen Shepard, the first guy to first American to be launched into space, and then the New Glenn, of course, after John Glenn, the first American to orbit Earth. That's the big rocket, and he's building that thing in Florida, and that's going to be orbital, and eventually put people on board, maybe tourists as well. That hasn't flown yet. It's supposed to fly at the end of this year, but it looks like it's going to be the end of 2022, so a little over, maybe a year and a half from now, that will finally fly. And that's going to be launched from Florida, Launch Complex 36. Jeff Bezos took that over from NASA, and he's rebuilt the whole NASA complex that's abandoned for many years, Launch Complex number 36. And they all have the complexes that they've taken over. Boeing has got Launch Complex 41. SpaceX took over two of them, Launch Complex 40. And, of course, Launch Complex 39A, that's the famous one that Apollo has launched out of, and the shuttle has launched out as well. So we'll see how that goes. Before I move on to another topic, any comments? Put it in. Not too far from here, in Wallops Island, Virginia. There's going to be a launch in a couple of days. Today is the 15th, so Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. They're going to launch a Minotaur 1 rocket from Wallops Island flight facility in Virginia. And it's going to be launched by Northrop Grumman. They've taken over Minotaur 1 launches if they go up. And that's a solid booster rocket. In fact, you could have up to 4 stages, I believe, on that rocket. So, and every stage is a solid booster. Which means once they light, they don't shut off. They're good to go. You can throttle them. But it's enough to get you into space. And they're launching a spacecraft for the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office. And usually there's 5 satellites of that number. Our regional spaceport, they call it Mars. Take the first letters of that, the Atlantic Regional Spaceport, that's what they come up with. And if you get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, where you are on Long Island, if you're on Long Island, it's going to be a different time frame. You'll be able to see it in the low horizon and outcase southwest. And it's not one of these deals where you're going to be looking at the reflection of the spacecraft of the sun, or to some degree that's true. But in this case, you'll be looking at the rock bench. Solid rock bench on the first stage. And there is a map, and it shows you, depending on where you're located, if you're closer to Wallops Island, you would see the light of the rocket engine within 10 seconds. If you're a little further away, maybe 20, 30 seconds. We're on Long Island, so map shows it's in yellow, and it would be roughly, it'll be between
60 and 90 seconds. It's closer to the center, the yellow part is the beginning of the yellow part is 60 seconds. So it's roughly 60 seconds there at the line. You'll be able to listen to it if you bring up the website. Or you have to put in wild silent launch of the National Reconnaissance Group, so NRO launch. You can put down the name of the satellite, anyway, I'll find it later. But if you put a National Reconnaissance Group orbit launch from Wild Sound, Virginia, June 13th, put it down YouTube, and you can watch the launch and know exactly the second that it will launch, and from that information, you'll be able to see it that morning from the island. It's not too high up the over the horizon, maybe 20 degrees, so that's about it. Polar line, so he'll probably go north and, over the North Atlantic Ocean. So it should be pretty interesting. I'll try to do that on Tuesday morning. It's the NROL 111 flight. National Orbital Launch number 111. Okay,
we drop it. Any comments? WB2EAV with a slightly off-topic comment.
Okay, before I forget, you can look at this map that I'm talking about on Roy's website, on roy.acgs. He has that picture up, as well as a couple of the other pictures.
Down those roads, but apparently they do it. And the third item is just a question. You were talking about Cape Canaveral, and the launch pad number is always like in the upper 30s. Is there any logic behind that? I know airplane runways are the compass heading. That's where they get the numbers from. Is there any system like that that you know of?
A lot of them have been abandoned, 1 through 14. I think 14 was being used in the Gemini, but many of them are abandoned. They could probably find something from that area. The ones that I mentioned have been in use for decades, either by manned spacecraft or unmanned spacecraft. But I know that there was a Launch Complex 36 that I mentioned that Jeff Bezos was taking over. It was a B, but A and B, 36, which B was never used. Things like that. Launch Complex 39A had a 39B, that's giving you a different number. You launched different shuttles, from 39A or 39B. All 135 shuttles were not launched from the same complex. It was either one or the other. So, as you go up the coast, the numbers tend to go up higher and higher. The ones towards the south, like 40 and things like that, and below that, 17, I think, which is for Viking. And those lower numbers are from Cape Canaveral, actually.
Where?
Up north. You know, there's actually a dividing point there where, you know, between the different ones, you know, where officially Cape Kennedy is located compared to Cape Canaveral, originally I think Army Proving Grounds or something. Anyway, you know, how many of them are active nowadays? You take like, what was the last complex? 13 has been completely eliminated. SpaceX went in there and put two big concrete landing facilities there. So when they have a Falcon 9 come back and land, that's worth landing at the old launch complex 13. It doesn't exist anymore now. It's just two big round concrete landing pads with the logo for SpaceX on. Back to you, Ed. I up the power. Hope it works. So we'll see. I know. Seldon was a little tough getting into tonight by other stations as well. Back to you, Ed.
Oh, much, much better. Okay, so apparently they are in numerical order. It's just that all the lower numbers have since been abandoned. It makes perfect sense. All right. Just to be really annoying, how long are they waiting for those concrete pads to cure based on our prior discussion?
Oh, I know they all wait 28 days, no matter what it is. And well, those pads have been cured. They've landed rockets back there many times so far. You know, like when they launched the really cool one was they did three of these so far, the Falcon 9 Heavies. When you take the Falcon 9 and you take three Falcon 9s, bump them together, and launch them at one time, you get 5.5 million pounds of thrust, and which is the biggest rocket on Earth right now. They set the core, it's supposed to go and land in the ocean on a ship, which has not really been successful yet. That's a problem. Sounded cool. And then boosted the other Falcon 9 rockets. They come back on their own. The one on the starboard and the port side, they come back at the exact same time and land at the exact same place. You know, two concrete landing pads there. They come down with the brake fins open up, well, you know, slow them down as they're coming through the atmosphere, and then right before they're landing, big legs open up, the four legs open up. One tip of one leg to the other is 60 feet long, and the one rocket engine, that's gimbal that, you know, moves very quickly, lands right on the money, and they also have assisting gasifying firing rockets with nitrogen near the top, which pushes it one way or the other to make sure help it land vertically. But yeah, that's the story with the concrete. Now, Elon Musk building a massive complex down in Texas, Boca Chica, Texas, and that's where he's testing his Starships out. He's got all kinds of support equipment that he's building massive tanks to hold methane and oxygen. He's building a facility to take the methane out of the ground that's down there, liquefy it, and then reuse that methane that's coming out of the ground for fuel. So it's a liquefying refrigeration type of complex he's building. He's got, you know, the equivalent of a vertical assembly building like NASA has, a VAB. This tall building that's big enough to build the Starship in. One piece of equipment after. And I'm sure every piece of concrete that he puts together, including the launch complex. Four launch complexes that are going to be in effect. They need two to test these Starships that they've been launching eventually get away from that, and it will be just a booster complex. You have to use that one yet, you know. So we'll see. And once he starts doing that, that will be the biggest, most thrust coming out of a rocket that's on Earth presently or ever, you know, or ever in the past. You know, NASA, the biggest one ever, was 7.5 million pounds of thrust. That was NASA with the Saturn rocket, and now the SLS that's being built down in Florida. By the way, that's going to be launched from Launch Complex 39B. See, 39A, Musk took over, you know, with SpaceX. 39B was still there. That's where the SLS will be launched from, and that will be that will be like in the beginning 8.5 million pounds of thrust. And then eventually those boosters are going to be increased in thrust over the years. Eventually they'll get that up to 10.5 million pounds of thrust. But the Starship that Elon Musk is building now in Texas will eventually be 16 million pounds of thrust. He plans on putting now 29 of these Raptor engines together and lighting them all up at one time, and that'll be the first stage. That will put the Starship into orbit, the second stage of this called the Starship. And that's going to have six engines, six of the same engines on the bottom of that. And hopefully, according to Elon Musk, everything will be reusable. Not in the beginning, those first 29 stages, first 29 rockets will be done away with. They're going to dump it in the Pacific Ocean. So, turning these things out like cookie cutter rocket engines down in Texas. Going to need to for a while. If he has a lot of failures, he's going to lose, you know, essentially 35 engines every launch. None of them make it. Now you might lose the 29 for the booster, and then the second stage might make it back to Earth. And the idea is to try to eventually land that back to Earth too. So you might only lose 29 instead of 30 or 35. Anyway, we'll continue on here. This is WS2N.
One more question. WS2N.
WB2EAB, go ahead.
You said that with a Saturn V with 7.5 million pounds of thrust, this new rocket is almost twice that. You said 13 million pounds. My question is, what is the weight of fuel and oxidizer on that vehicle? And the reason I'm asking, I was read an item saying, what were the biggest non-nuclear man-made explosions in history? And I think a ship full of ammonium nitrate fertilizer blowing up from Galveston and Harbor Earth around, by around 1940. One candidate, another one was a Russian space launch, was another one. And these two explosions were on the order of magnitude of a quarter of the Hiroshima blast. This one might tie it if it blows up on takeoff.
Okay, you have the, Saturn V was roughly 6.5 million pounds of thrust, but you always need more than whatever type of, 6.5 pounds sitting on a launch complex with 6.5 million pounds with the fuel and everything. Always need more, so that's why that was 7.5 million pounds of thrust to get this thing off the launch pad. And quickly, of course, that's, you know, inside of 30 seconds or so, you're about to lose, you know, most of your fuel, so now it gets lighter and lighter, but yes, it's going faster and faster. And that's how they get to orbit. And then you have the SLS, which is the one they're building now, it's going to be around 8.5 million pounds of thrust. You know, the rocket is going to be a little less than that, maybe the weight, you know, 7.5 million pounds. You need 8.5 million pounds to get it off the ground. And that will be eventually up to around 10.5 once know, a cyclotron, they're going to use drug box boosters. And then Elon Musk has his design is going to be up to 16 million pounds of thrust. And, you know, so I would envision that probably be, you know, maybe 14 million pound rocket. You know, the one that blew up is called the N1, November 1 rocket that Russia blew up. They had 33 engines. I think they, all the KN-33 KN-33 rocket engines. I think there were 33 of those engines all, you know, piped together. And unfortunately, it did blow up on the launch pad. Yeah, I mean, that was going to be that moon rocket. And it was going to be multiple stages, you know, like four stages. And they were going to put one guy on top to get him to the moon and back, not three people like we have. What we did. So, yeah, and then another one, they tried to do it again, and that one failed as well. So, you know, they had, from what I read, leaky pipes and things like that. And, you know, one thing led to another, it was a catastrophic failure. And I guess, like you said, probably like Hiroshima. Back to you, Ed.
Yeah, I read somewhere it was like before the blast, Hiroshima. I remember. Hiroshima, they said, was roughly 20,000 tons of TNT. I would assume rocket fuel has about the same energy that city, give or take, as TNT. So I would think if you have 20,000 tons of fuel and oxidizer on board, it blows up on the launch pad like that Russian M1 does, you could tie the Hiroshima blast. Totally an academic discussion. Heaven help us if we get a chance to run the test.
Okay. Yeah. You got a good idea. That made me wonder why they plan on eventually launching the Starship, these 16 million pound thrust thing from the Gulf of Mexico. You know, Elon Musk bought these two oil rigs and he's going to float them out to sea, and that's where he plans on launching and even maybe landing, you know, to boost his back on a facility. And he's, you know, he's presently outfitting them to do just that. Of course, I don't know when that's going to ever take place. He'll probably launch the first, or well, I know he's going to launch the first test one from Texas, you know, from the from land. But eventually, they'll launch from sea. In fact, he named them the two oil platforms called Deimos and Phobos, which are the two names of the Mars moons that are going to go around Mars. Quite a character, you know. And that's what you do when you have billions of dollars, you know, like one of the richest people in the world, I guess. It's really amazing. It's really pouring a lot of money into it. Any other comments? Okay. I guess not. You know, there's also another picture on Roy's website. It's a picture of the Chinese rover on Mars. And as well as the lander that brought it down to the surface. So when China launched this thing back last summer, in July, they sent really essentially three spacecraft to Mars at the same time, one in orbiter, and then this whole setup separated from that orbiter. That's like the last mothership that's still in orbit, acting as a relay for China's rovers and landers. So the land landed successfully after months in orbit, figured out where they wanted to land, and then they have a rover that came off of it called the Sojong. I think it was the Jiayang, but spelled with a Z. And Jiayang is riding around now on Mars. But they thought about, I guess, what it would look like, you know, to
the people of China. So the rover had with it, you know, it's got a robotic arm and everything. It had a camera, and, you know, that was independent of everything. And they placed it down on the surface of Mars and then backed away from it. And in the picture, you can see the picture of their rover and their lander next to one another. When you first look at it, you say, who took this picture? But then, as you read the article, they tell you what they did. It's a separate camera. And they do weird things like that. And when they went to Mars, on the way to Mars, they had another camera separated from the mothership. Again, a year where a camera flew away from the spacecraft and looked back at the picture of the spacecraft, transmitted probably on 77 centimeters back to the orbiter, and then in turn that was transmitted back to, they have their own deep space network to, in this case it was Argentina. Then they have a antenna set up in Argentina. They don't use the deep space network for NASA, and NASA, you know, we don't have an agreement with China to do any of this stuff that they do in space. So they're not allowed to use the deep space network. So, you know, those three topics are really covered on Roy.ACCGS website. You can have the picture of the surrounding Wallops Island, Virginia, to figure out the best time to actually look for the rocket engine you saw, and then of course you have the picture of what the inside of the Shepard looks like, the seating arrangement, like, you know, they're going to be leaning back and apparently looking out these big windows. I have they advertise that the biggest windows ever made, you know, to travel to space. So, you know, they're making it like that's a real big deal, but, you know, officially this thing doesn't go over like 3,000 miles an hour. Suborbital, you know, up three times the speed of sound, gets into space, and then comes back down. You know, you don't have the heating effect of re-entry like you do when you do a normal orbital launch. You'll come back at, you know, 17,500 miles an hour, and it'll slow it down maybe 500 to 1,000 miles an hour with their retro rockets when you hit the atmosphere. You can't have this massive window like they have in the Shepard on Jeff Bezos' rocket. Something that big, I don't think would survive, you know, multiple thousands of degrees of temperature coming from the atmosphere. So he doesn't have to worry about that. He's got to get his suborbital spacecraft into orbit. First stage has to separate, usually roughly about 2 minutes in, probably around the 48 to 50 mile range up, and then the spacecraft itself can coast the rest of the way until it gets up to 300-some-odd thousand feet, or, you know, just over the 62-mile range, and then it comes back down. Now, there's another company, Virgin Galactic, run by Richard Branson, and he's been trying to do this too. You know, he's got the, it's called Unity now, the Unity launch vehicle. It's more of an airplane or a space plane. He attaches it to the carrier. The carrier has a name called the White Knight. You know, with these jet engines, brings them up to, you know, 45,000 feet, and then they drop it like a bomb. And then after a few seconds, the hybrid engine that it has, you know, lights, takes them to, again, to the common line, supposedly. The idea is to go straight up, suborbital,
back down and land
on the runway.
And that takes place in